And good evening. My name is Don Ecker. The show is UFOs Tonight. You're listening to the Cable Radio Network. And tonight our show is being brought to you and sponsored by Super Science. These are the folks that you're going to be hearing more about later on this evening. Make sure you have a pencil or a piece of paper so you can take down some information. I have some stuff I think you're going to find very interesting. And as I promised last week, tonight I have a special guest in studio with me. Somebody that if you've been within the UFO field for any length of time, you've heard his name, you may have seen him on television, on hundreds of radio shows, and author of the very first book on one of UFOdom's probably most originally screwed down cover-ups ever, The Roswell Incident, by none other than William L. Moore. Bill, good evening and welcome to UFOs Tonight.
Good evening, Don. How are you?
Well, not too bad. I've got your book here in front of me. You're probably the first guy to ever publicly address this in a large forum. And as a result of this book being published, a lot of unusual things have happened through the years. I'd love to touch on some of that. But how did you originally get involved in something as deeply screwed down and as covert as an alleged crash of an ET craft in Roswell, New Mexico?
It started over a pizza, Don, on a 40 degree below zero evening in Minnesota back in January of 1979. A gentleman that was a very old friend of mine, I'd known from the 1960s in Pittsburgh, Stanton Friedman, had come to Minnesota and was delivering a presentation at the University of Minnesota Morris campus. And at the time, I was teaching high school in nearby Herman, Minnesota, lived in Morris. And I happened to see in the newspaper that Stanton was coming to town, so I just went over there, hadn't seen him in some years, and we renewed an acquaintanceship. Well, that evening after his presentation, we went to the only place in town that was still open, which happened to be the local pizza parlor. Colder than a... Well, you know what, it was colder then. And
a well digger's lunch bucket, no doubt.
That'll work. And it was over the pizza and the conversation that followed that we discovered that for the first time that either one of us was aware of, we seemed to have more than one story that seemed to relate to a crash of some kind of an object in New Mexico in the late 1940s. Now, up to that time, there had been a lot of crash saucer stories out there.
Frank Scully, for example,
not the least of which, publishing a book in 1950, which turned out to be based on a very sophisticated hoax, which, by the way, is the subject of a very lengthy paper I just finished updating. But in any case, Stanton and I sat and exchanged notes, and he had a piece of the Roswell story. I had a smaller piece of it. And what we decided was that this was the first time in either one of us, our knowledge, that there were two stories that seemed to relate to the same crash event. In all other cases, there was one and only one, and you could never trace it down. It would always go back to it. Mike Waller, dead end.
Okay, well, let's stop a minute now. July 1947, the event happens. The United States Army Air Corps, which is the forerunner of the U.S. Air Force, stated one of their most top-secret elite bomber groups, the 509th, the only people in the world at that time that had an atomic capability, a nuclear capability, stated through their public relations officer that the Army Air Corps captured a flying disc, a disc. Then within a few hours, the commander of the 8th Air Force, Roger Ramey, overturns it, says, no, we made a mistake. It was nothing more than a weather balloon. And for the next 40-odd years, that was it, right? I mean, there was nothing else. Nobody talked about it, or if they did, it was in whispers. What was the one piece of information or evidence that came out that reignited this controversy?
Well, as I say, it began with Stanton and I discussing this over a pizza. And from that, it led to an agreement between Stanton and I to see what we could do to check it out. He had heard one of the pieces that he had almost a year earlier had been doing a show in New Orleans, Louisiana. The host of the show happened to mention a local gentleman that had said something about having been involved with the wreckage of a crash saucer. Stanton got interested, spoke to the man briefly, and it turned out that that was Jess Marcel. Stan didn't know what to do with that story. He had told it to a couple of other UFO researchers. They didn't know what to do with it. In fact, did nothing with it. Len Stringfield had it 9 months before I did and did nothing with it. I determined that I was going to see what I could learn. And so I embarked on an extremely lengthy and involved field investigation, beginning on the 22nd of January of 1979 and going hot and heavy. I mean, I was getting $600 and $800 a month phone bills for a while, made about a dozen trips to New Mexico in the space of the next 2 years, chasing down witnesses, finding press clippings. I went to the University of Minnesota Wilson Library in Minneapolis and spent a day researching press clippings, came up with a whole flock of them, which in essence backed up much of what Jess Marcel had already told
me. Now, Jess Marcel, the name that you mentioned, was in 1947 the intelligence officer for the 509.
Yeah, he was major. He was, in fact, one of the staff officers. I think he was fifth in the chain of command at the Roswell base. He was S4, which was intelligence. And it was his job to coordinate the collection of any kind of field intelligence, whatever national security items, anything else that came across his desk. And the local rancher, Mac Brazel, who had found this stuff on his ranch, didn't know what it was, came into town, contacted the sheriff. Sheriff, following a set of prearranged instructions, thought, well, it's military, whatever it is, contacted the base, was put in touch with Marcel. Marcel came out and interviewed the rancher Brazel and subsequently followed him to the ranch, where they picked up quite a quantity of debris. They were out there for almost a day, stayed overnight. And it was all of this peripheral material that came in from people who, each one of them had some small piece of the story, but nobody seemed to know the whole thing.
Okay, Bill, we're going to have to take a quick break. We're going to have to pay some homage to our sponsors. And when we come back, more on the Roswell incident. My guest this evening is William L. Moore, co-author of The Roswell Incident, along with Charles Berlitz. And Mr. Moore is also the first individual to shed some light on something called MJ-12, and he has a tremendous amount of information on the Paul Benowitz affair, which, if we have time tonight, we hope to be able to cover. If you'd like to speak to my guest or myself, and you live in the 818-310 or 213 area codes, you can are back. Bill, prior to the Roswell incident, and of course...
I was just wondering, Don, after that commercial, is there anything left to be said?
Prior to the Roswell incident, look, we have to treat all our sponsors just
They're very good people down there at Unarius. I do say that. We had great cooperation from them and the piece we just did about them.
Was there anybody talking about anything having to do with crash saucers prior to your book coming out?
There was some talk around. I don't know that I'd call it really serious. There were some people around that were making noises.
All right, let me ask you this. Have you ever heard of the 4602nd Air Intelligence Service Squadron?
Certainly.
Okay. Who are they?
Who were they?
Who were they?
They were one in a series of units that provided support to various commands and projects and operations under the Air Force Intelligence during the 1950s and 60s. And they were the unit that was designated by, I believe it was Air Force Regulation 200.2, which was promulgated back in the early 1950s, to assist Project Blue Book in the collection of field intelligence data. And whenever Blue Book had what they regarded as a good UFO case that they wanted to do something with, they were able to enlist the assistance of the 4602nd wherever 4602nd personnel might have been. They were stationed all over the country.
They were stationed
in detachments all over the place.
Right.
And they were subsequently phased out in favor of another unit whose number I forget, and ultimately Blue Book itself was closed down, and I think after 200-2 was replaced by, was it 8611, I think they were phased out.
Okay, and one of what I consider my own personal opinion, one of the great UFO investigators, especially in the beginning of the UFO age, the modern UFO age, was Major Donald Kehoe. And in his book published in 1955, The Flying Saucer Conspiracy, which if you can find a copy of it, there's some absolutely fantastic information in here. In one of the chapters titled The Invisible Saucers, where they were talking about some sightings or radar sightings where they were not able to visually pick up the objects, he was mentioning, or he was referring to the 4602nd, which had a special program called the Investigation of Unidentified Crashed Objects.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And as he states in the book, I got the impression that they'd recovered some kind of an object. And, of course, the first thing that hit me was Roswell and the Corona areas. How are an entity like the Air Force able to keep something like this hidden?
Well, what you've done there is mixed apples and oranges, so let's sort them back out here. First of all, the 4602nd, in addition to being connected with assisting Blue Book personnel, was also connected to something called Project Moondust.
Right.
Moondust actually had three divisions: Moondust, Blue Fly, and UFO. And they were somewhat connected in the extent that all three were targeted toward trying to collect any kind of wreckage that might have come out of the sky. Blue Fly had to do with wreckage from space objects that were primarily Soviet in nature. Moondust seems to have been more of an overseer kind of project that was connected in with NASA in some way. And UFO, of course, was the Blue Book connection. Now, I have in our library, I think it's two rolls of microfilm on the records of the 4602nd, and what they called their UFOB project, UFOB. And they're pretty innocuous, really. There isn't a whole lot there that seems to be...
And anything that would have had to do with this phenomenon, I'm sure, would have been classified and probably...
Well, certainly it would have, and it wouldn't have been in the historical records. It would have gone somewhere in the compartmented records, which have never been released.
Let's take some phone calls. I've got John calling from Van Nuys United Artists on number 2. Hello, John. John, are you there? Guess not. Okay.
John was abducted.
Let's go to number 4, Billy from Multivision in Anaheim. Good evening, Billy.
Hello, Don. Enjoy your show very much.
Well, thank you.
I have two questions for Mr. Moore, and I would like to take the answers off the air so I can tape them.
Sure.
I hope that's possible.
Okay.
Okay, to begin with, Mr. Moore, at the 1989 MUFON Symposium, you publicly admitted to a long career as a controlled intelligence informant and said that you had purposely deceived quite a few research investigators. In consideration of this, why would any serious researcher or student of the subject give you any credence whatsoever or think that any information that you supply is anything more than a cutout or general disinformation?
Okay, and your second question,
and the second question is, if you can answer this honestly, could you explain to us the details of your personal connection to Scott Jones, as well as the SciTech group, and exactly what types of clandestine projects you were working on with Mr. Jones, as well as Lieutenant Colonel John Alexander and General Stubblebine? And
okay, is that it, Billy?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay,
bye.
You're going to go back to your radio.
I'm going
to
go hit the record button.
Okay.
All right, thanks a lot.
Okay, Bill, she's got you on the spot, pal.
I'm glad she asked those questions.
Well,
because,
if she wouldn't have, I would have.
Seems like there's a lot of disinformation and misinformation floating around out there. and a great deal of that is very erroneous. First of all, I did get up in Las Vegas in 1989 and make quite a startling statement to a lot of people. Those who were there, and Don was there, so he can verify this.
You even heard me, didn't you?
Noted that I did something there that I had never done before and have never done since. And that is that I read, word for word, the paper that I presented. Now, why did I do that? Because I did not want there to be any question afterwards as to what I said. So I read the text, and that text is still available. If you don't have a copy of it, maybe you should get one, because obviously what you have heard and what I said are two different things. I never said that I had any involvement with the creation or dissemination of disinformation by anybody. What I did say was that I was aware of a project and had been, to a very small extent, a part of one, wherein there was disinformation created and spread, and wherein it was directed at a specific individual, in this case Mr. Benowitz in New Mexico, for some purpose that I never fully and completely understood.
Okay, well, let's stop there a second. Let me ask you this. Basically, in fact, what you stated was that you reported back to people, and I'm presuming it was OSI, Office of Special Investigations, is that correct?
That's right.
On Benowitz. Do you feel that was an ethical act that you carried out?
Well, that was the next point I was going to make. Let's stop for a moment and consider, what was my motive here? Was it money? No. Because I never took a penny for what I did. I wouldn't take money for it. I turned money down for it. I spent money out of my own pocket. Was it fame and fortune? No. Certainly I've not gained any fame from it, unless it's the notoriety that some people ascribe to that. Fortune? Certainly not that.
Well, you have to admit that overall it did in fact damage your credibility as a researcher.
I think it only damaged it in the minds of some people who were not willing to hear what I wanted to say or what I was trying to say.
Okay, well, let me ask you this.
Well, let me finish here. What I was really trying to do, and what I think I did, was to involve myself in something which I did not agree with. Never did agree with what was going on with Benowitz, but couldn't say so. Because the minute I would have said something, I would have simply been dropped and replaced by somebody who would have played the game their way. There's one thing you learn when you get into this kind of a situation, and that is that you either play the game according to their rules, or you don't play.
Okay, now,
and my motive was to learn as much about this as I could, so that ultimately, at some point down the line, when I was free to talk about it, I could tell others what had happened, and to make them aware that this kind of thing does happen. And the only way that we would have known anything about what happened with Benowitz and that whole situation is because I got myself involved with it and because I went public with it. Had I not done that, no one to this day would have been aware of what had happened there. And part of that whole situation was the creation by people at higher levels than I was at of very wild stories having to do with underground alien bases and secret treaties between us and aliens. The first time I ever heard the term Greys was when they fed it to Benowitz. They invented all that.
We're going to have to break for a quick commercial, Bill. When we come back, I want to get back into this. We have some more calls to take. And I want to ask you why you refused to take questions at the 89.
Let's not forget the other half of the question on Scott Jones there either.
Nope, I've got it right here. And I want to talk about how the Southern California Gas Company figures into all this.
I wish I
knew. And as soon as we get back, we'll be talking about it. Okay, where can you find out more information? We've got Tony, who's been hanging on patiently from Rochester, New York. Good evening, Tony.
Good evening, Don. How are you?
This Tony! I know you. How you doing?
Good, Don. Very good. How you doing?
As a matter of fact, Tony is from a production company called New Century Production, and these folks have just recently released, in my opinion, what is the definitive documentary on the Roswell incident. Tell us a little bit about it, Tony.
Well, Don, I'd like to say, first of all, that we started this project about 3 years ago. I actually got involved with it because I was attempting to try to debunk this particular story. I had no belief in UFOs as being extraterrestrial, and I took this to a friend of mine, hoping that he would write a book about debunking UFOs and Roswell in particular.
Can you speak up a little, Tony? I can. You're having a
sure.
Hard time.
How's that, Don?
That's much better.
Well, we took this. I took this information to a friend of mine, hoping that he would write a book about debunking UFOs and the Roswell incident in particular. He came back to me and asked me if I wanted to do a documentary, and I said, no way did I want my name attached to anything that would have anything to do with UFOs. Well, to make a long story short, we ended up doing this documentary, and I turned out from a skeptic to a believer. And over 3 years now, I've had the opportunity to try to debunk this. Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt have been gracious enough to fill me in on a lot of the information that they have gathered and allowed me to try to punch holes in it, and I just have not been able to punch holes in it.
Well, you know, we have one of the original Roswell investigators right here this evening in studio, Bill Moore.
Is that right?
Have you read Bill's book?
I beg your pardon?
Have you read Bill's book, The Roswell Incident?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, with all due respect, I remember that book was given to me to read because my partner wanted me to do a documentary on it. And after I got through reading it, I said, I just don't believe this story. I do not believe it.
What was it that changed your mind?
Don, I got to know this story in such detail, and then I spoke to the witnesses, and as I said earlier, for 3 years, I tried as hard as I could to try to debunk this story. And I'd say what put me over the edge was about 6 months ago, I think Don and Kevin came up with more information, which just put me over the top. If I had to single anything out, I would probably say the credibility of the witnesses.
And that is devastating in this documentary. Tony, we have got to go. We've got to take the half-hour break. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Sure, we'll be talking to you soon.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. And we'll be right back after these messages.
So is it? What this thing, as far as I was concerned, was all about. Beyond that, whether I had maintained my own involvement or had simply dropped it or had been dropped from it wouldn't have had the least bit effect on the outcome of the whole thing. They knew what they were doing, they knew what they were going to do, and they knew how they were going to do it. And there wasn't anything I could do about that except to learn as much as I could and ultimately to expose it, which is what I did. And because I exposed it, the very people whose reputations stood to lose from the things that I exposed as disinformation were the people who screamed the loudest and the people who claimed that I was some kind of a counter-agent or a double agent and so on. There were a lot of people back in 89 who had bought into the whole underground base secret treaty with aliens, grays and blondes and the 9 yards of that crap that came out of the government and was dumped into Benowitz's lap and that he gobbled up as fast as they could feed it to him. And there were a lot of people in the UFO field that Benowitz was talking to who accepted what he said. And those stories were very prevalent in 1989 until I got up and said, wait a minute, folks, this is all disinformation and here's how I know. And then all of a sudden, the very people who were peddling those stories to an unsuspecting public screamed bloody murder. It was all my fault. I was the bad guy. And all I had done was said, hey, guys, you've been hell.
Let me break in here. I got to ask you a couple of things. Okay, number one, in 1969, at the completion of the Common Committee report, the Air Force stated there's nothing to UFOs, no national security considerations. Now, we know that that's crap. We also know that the United States of America is supposed to be the last bastion of democracy, a republic with laws, and everybody, no matter whom you are, is accountable. Now, I think everyone in this room right now will agree to that. However, we can see a very troubling series of events that have been happening all over the country, including the Benowitz affair. Now, regardless of what the man was ultimately involved in, if in fact he crossed the bounds of national security, why drive him into an insane asylum instead of locking him up in a federal penitentiary? Now, to show how far these tactics of covert mongering have gone. Would you believe, Bill, that the other day the gas man came out to my house to read the meter? Now, the gas man has a key to the gate to get into my backyard. Now, I have dogs. He got into the yard, read the meter, never notified me that he was there because that was part of our agreement. You come in the yard, it's locked, you let us know. He left, the gate was wide open. Now, luckily, I caught that before the dogs went outside and maybe ran out in the street and got hit. But I was upset, so I called up the gas company to complain. Now, while I'm telling the woman at the gas company what's going on, in the background, I hear this beep, beep, very faint beep. And I stopped and I asked her, I said, "Are you recording this conversation?" And she said, "Yes, I am." I said, "Well, are you aware that under California statute that you're supposed to tell me that you're recording this conversation?" "No, I don't have to. We just have the beep." So I got upset and I called up the Attorney General. And I knew that it was correct, but under Penal Code 632 through 635, it states emphatically that if you're recording somebody, you have to tell them or you can spend $2,500 in a year in jail. So I called them back. The same thing, I'm being recorded again. I finally get a supervisor, and they're just blatantly shameless about it. Now, if the gas company can record you, and anybody that's listening in Southern California, when you call up the Southern Cal gas people, they're going to record you. You know it ahead of time. Let them know on the air. If you don't like it, hey, I don't like you recording me. Call up the Attorney General. But if they can do it, who knows what in the world the Air Force can do. And according to your story, the Air Force did one hell of a job on Benowitz. You knew about it. Now, how do you explain your willingness to go along with this project up to that point? And I'll let you finish now. I'll get off my soapbox. And anybody from the gas company, I promised you I was going to do this. I'm still upset about it. So
I want to hear about Scott Jones, too.
A plague on the gas company's house. I will repeat, Don, that if I had not done what I did, no one today would have been aware of what had happened to Paul Benowitz at all. No one would have known whether the stories he was telling were true or not true. There simply wasn't anybody else in that picture who was involved enough with it to know anything about what was going on, who was in a position to come out and tell the public, as I was. Being a journalist, somebody that does a lot of media, that was what I was trying to find out. Now, a lot of people said, "Well, you participated, that must mean, that implies that you agreed with it." To which I say, nonsense. If I hadn't participated, somebody else would have, and the same result would have been. Now, why did they discredit him and do what they did instead of simply putting him in jail? I don't know. I can't explain or excuse the motivations of people whose motivations I don't know from up front. I never knew, and I don't know of anybody that does know that would say what it was that they were trying to cover. I know that there were a lot of UFO stories connected with it, but I never knew for certain whether it was UFO related or whether that was simply a convenient way to divert attention from something else.
My guest this evening is William L. Moore, author of The Roswell Incident and the man that brought us the MJ-12 documents. I still want to talk to Bill about that. If you'd like to speak to my guest and you're in the 818-213 or 310 area codes, call me at 818-352-7152. And we have Matt from Santa Monica on Century Cable who's been waiting patiently.
Yeah,
good evening,
hi.
Matt.
Good evening, Don. Real quickly, I had two paragraph. It's a short statement that I thought you might be interested in, and I'd like a comment from Mr. Moore as well. It's from a CIA Special Task Force document on greater CIA openness regarding the media, if you'd permit me.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, let me do this quickly. It says the PAO, Public Affairs Office, now has a relationship with reporters and executives from every major wire service, newspaper, news weekly, and television network in the nation. This has helped us turn some intelligence failure stories into intelligence success stories, and it has contributed to the desired accuracy of countless other stories. I point out they state desired accuracy. In many instances, we have managed to persuade reporters to postpone, hold, make desired change, or even scrap stories that in agency opinion could have adversely affected national security. and national security interests or jeopardize sources and methods of particular operations. And I thought you'd find that fascinating. It's from a December 20th release of a task force report that's 15 pages that was promptly stamped secret. Second question, well, not second question, the first question that I have for Mr. Moore. Mr. Moore, in your magazine Focus on December 31st, 89 issue, you made a claim that two individuals by the name of Alan Benz and Ed Beeble were CIA agents.
I didn't make that claim. You misread it. But go ahead.
Okay, well, then why you retracted the statement that you'd made in the December 31st issue and your September 30th, 90 issue?
That is correct.
Well, if you didn't make the statement, why did you retract it?
You have to read the statement that I made.
I did read it.
What I was doing, if you had read it very carefully, was reporting what I had been told at the office of the tribal secretary of the Jicarilla Apaches in Dulce, New Mexico.
Okay, well, don't you think that it's slightly irresponsible to just regurgitate what you've been told by somebody that's a third party to an issue? Mr. Alan Benz, for instance, is not a CIA agent. He's a librarian in Arizona.
Well, I knew that. That is why I reported the story as being preposterous.
And then why did you retract what you'd
reported
as being preposterous?
Because I got a letter from Beeble stating that they had not even been. Yeah, well, let's back up here a minute, because
okay.
You get this thing so confused that to try to explain it to you and to respond to what you're saying doesn't make any sense.
I have it confused.
Yes, you certainly do. What I had reported was that I had been in Dulce, New Mexico, with a Japanese television crew. And in the process of dozing around, we had been referred to the tribal secretary's office, and in the process of talking to her, she had told me that there had been, the previous week, two CIA agents, and this is what she told me, there had been two CIA agents in town, they had a trunkload of camera equipment, and they were particularly interested in one area of the reservation which was somewhat south of the town of Dulce itself, and I forget the name of the canyon involved. And in the process of trying to get more information about that, I said, well, did these agents give you any names? Did they show you credentials? Did they, you know, do you have any way of knowing that, in fact, they were CIA people? And she said, oh, yes, they gave me their names, and I have them written down in my desk. And she went across the office and pulled the drawer open and came out with this tablet. And on the tablet were the names Alan Benz and Ed Beeble. And I said, well, you know, I know those two, and they are not CIA agents. What makes you think that they are? And she said, well, they told me that they were. So I reported that story in Focus.
Now, well, then what do you feel the need to retract the story?
Because I got a letter from Beeble stating that they had not ever even been in Dulce, New Mexico.
So
that they hadn't been there at all. In other words, someone else, if this story is true at all, had been there and had given their names. I don't know who that someone else was or where these names came from, except that they were given to me by the tribal secretary, and that was the story I was told. Now, I never said they were CIA agents.
Well, the article.
And when I got the letter from Beeble, I wrote a retraction stating that they had not even been in Dulce. Now, if you go back and read what I wrote, I think you'll find it consistent with what I just said and not with what you just claimed.
Okay, well, I will have to do that.
Please do.
That's not the way that I read it at all.
So many times people read things and they see what they want to see and not what is there.
Well, I'll tell you what, let me put you all on hold. We've got to take a quick break, and when we come back, Matt, I want you to get it ended up here because we have some more phone calls
okay,
and some more stuff to talk about.
All
so
right.
Just let me get Matt on here real quick. Matt, are you there?
Yeah, Don.
Okay, let's get it
just wrap
get moved up here.
Okay, basically, Don, I just wanted to know what your opinion is. I'm going to send you a copy of the 15-page report the CIA released in December on their greater openness policy. They basically are stating they have the media all wrapped up, which isn't much of a surprise. Just in closing, Mr. Moore, your rationalization earlier and your qualifying of the fact that what was mentioned at the top of the show with your earlier intelligence involvements, basically, I don't care what your interpretation of it is, it basically is a statement that you, you know, and I think you said it yourself, you'd screw under anybody to keep yourself in the fold. I don't think that that's proper rationalization for anybody in this field. I don't care how important you think it is. And quite frankly, you know, I don't think you can give us any answers to that. But anyway,
well,
thanks, Don.
Will.
Enjoy the show.
I'd be happy to give you an answer.
Okay,
too.
Matt, do you have it on radio?
Yeah, sure do.
Okay, I'm going to let Bill go ahead.
My response to that is that I deeply respect this gentleman's opinion, and I reserve the right in this democracy that we have, which I'm very proud of, to dissent from it. I think his opinion derives from a position of, shall we say, jumping to conclusions without benefit of all of the facts at hand. I think if he had all of the facts and had been in my shoes, he would have done very much as I did. And I would remind him again that instead of being the bad guy here, I'm the guy that blew the whistle and alerted the UFO community of the fact that this stuff is going on. And for having done that, suddenly I get vilified by the very people who are trying to capitalize on the very disinformation stories that were being spread around there. It was a calculated and very theatrical presentation in Vegas. It was calculated to stick in people's minds long after the fact. It certainly did that. I've spoken to 17 people who were there, and I've asked them all the same question, and that was, who spoke before I did? And not one of them could answer the question correctly, which says that my goal in making that particular presentation a matter of memory was very successful. I did it the way that I did it because I wanted it to stick in people's minds and be controversial for a long time, because I think this whole business of government disinformation in the UFO field is reprehensible, and because I was in a position to see enough of it to see how it worked and to see where a lot of it was coming from and who was involved with it. That story is still in the process of being told.
Well, that brings me to the next logical question. A lot of people at the 1989 MUFON symposium felt that your overall persona during a period of time was one of pure arrogance. Now, the question is, after you gave your over 2-hour speech, and there were hundreds of people, literally, that wanted to ask you questions, and you were in a position to answer a lot of those questions if you chose, you turned around and split Vegas and took no questions. My big question is why?
I thought I just answered that. It was all part of a carefully planned theatrical performance. It was something that if you've ever seen me speak before, you know, first of all,
sure,
that I don't read my papers.
Are you saying that the people that you allegedly had worked with, the people in OSI, gave you permission to do this?
No.
Did they tell you not to do it?
It was a product to some extent of enough time having passed that I was now in a position to speak on my own and freely within certain limits. Since that time, going on to 4 years now have passed, and there are more things that I'm able to talk about than I was at that time. If you have not, and I'm sure a lot of listeners out there are familiar with this whole thing only by hearsay, if you have not read the text of what I said before you form any opinions, you should read it, and read it very carefully. And that is available from us. It's one of the back issues of Focus from June of 1989, and it contains the complete text as I read it, word for word, at Vegas. It explains pretty much itself. It takes the UFO community over the coals for not being alerted to this thing on their own beforehand and for being gullible enough to buy a lot of the stuff that was floating around without bothering to check
but
it.
Yet at that time, Bill, and I distinctly remember this, and I've heard you speak at several different lectures, symposiums, you indicated on several occasions that you had personal knowledge, which you evidently still have personal knowledge, of some other people within the UFO community that you say is doing exactly what you did years ago. In other words, they are reporting back to representatives within the government on various things and people within the UFO community, but you won't identify them. Are they doing damage to the overall research community?
I don't think so.
Opinion?
No, not the ones that I know. They're simply reporting data back. They're
modeling. Data such as
just,
what?
It's pretty much open literature kind of data. There is a collection of data going on by a variety of government agencies on the subject of UFOs, some of which includes what they call HUMINT, which is human intelligence. Intelligence garnered from other humans, so to speak. Why they do that thing, I don't know. But, you know, there's ELINT, and there's SIGINT, and there's HUMINT, and human intelligence is simply that gained from people. And there are some individuals who are fairly prominent in the UFO community that are feeding that kind of stuff.
Do they work for the gas company?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Okay, I've got something.
They may have a lot of gas within them.
I've got a question here. A caller called in, wanted me to pass this on to you. And I'm going to read it verbatim from this card. In 1983, you and Stanton Friedman met with Stan Dale. Is that true or not?
1983, it's not true.
Okay, did you meet with Stan Dale?
Yes, I did.
Do you recall what year it was?
It was early 1982.
Okay, well then we're a year off, but we've got the right guy. A one-word response was asked for in order to get some information. What was the one-word response, and what was the info?
I wish I knew.
Do you know what they're talking about?
No, I have no idea.
Then that's Round Fell.
Okay, no,
back to the Round Fell. My guest is Bill Moore. My name is Don Ecker. The show is UFOs Tonight. This is the Cable Radio Network, and tonight's program is being brought to you by Super Science, the people that bring us the Magnetic Field Distortion Detector and the ELF Generator. Bill, Scott Jones, John Alexander, SciTech. Scott Jones is somebody I wrote a sidebar on here, a year ago? A mysterious fellow in the UFO field. Some people have even claimed he is the mysterious falcon from your aviary. What do you have to say about it? Is Scott Jones real? Is he
real? Yes, of course.
Is he sneaky? Is he the falcon? What's the deal?
Well, he's certainly not the falcon. If people want to believe that, they're welcome to believe it. You know, I think that's pretty true with anything that comes out of the work I'm doing. I'm not proselytizing anybody. I'm not out there saying, you got to believe this because that's the way it is. I'm saying, here it is. Do with it what you want. I do tend to be in a position to back up just about anything I say, or I won't say it, or I'll qualify it.
You're absolutely correct.
I've had several meetings with Scott Jones over the years. I find him to be a fascinating individual. I'm not entirely sure what he's all about.
Former Navy intelligence, former legislative aide to Senator Claiborne
Pell. Senator Pell, that's true. In fact, I met Senator Pell one time socially with Scott Jones, long enough to say hello. I do not know what Scott Jones's personal agenda may be. I know he's very much involved in psychic research and that sort of thing, and very active in it, or was. I've not seen him in some time. Certainly, as far as his being much assistance to me, I don't know that he was all that much. The SciTech thing, it's something I first heard about not more than about a year and a half ago. And I have had, to my knowledge, one telephone conversation with one of their people. He called me, and that was just about a year ago.
Was it at Dames?
No, it was not. In fact, frankly, I don't remember what the man's name was, but it was not Ed Dames. And it was not any of the ones that have been pretty commonly bantered about, which is the reason I don't remember it. I'm sure I wrote it down. I think they're into remote viewing, and quite a lot of things that they do are pretty spacey as far as I'm concerned. I've never met General Stubblebine. I've only heard the name and heard about his appearances in places. I had one telephone conversation with a gentleman by the name of Pandolfi, who claimed to be with the CIA. He called me, and we talked for about 10 minutes, and he mentioned SciTech, and I think it was at his behest that the person who called me from SciTech called me. I have virtually no working knowledge of what that group is doing, aside from what they've published. I've read some of Dames's reports, and I think they read like science fiction.
Bill, we are just almost within seconds of being out of time. I apologize for not mentioning it earlier. However, you are the editor of a new publication put out by LFP Publications called Far Out. Tell us very briefly about this magazine and how folks out there can find out more about it and how they can get it.
Well, Far Out, by way of being a new publication, we're into our first year now. Is on the newsstands. It's distributed nationally. It is not limited specifically to UFOs, but rather to any kind of unexplained, unusual paranormal phenomena. regardless of what it may be, in even to some extent lost gold mines and lost treasures and stories of encounters with psychic phenomena of all kinds. We do have UFO material. We have been focusing on the business in Nevada quite a lot in all of the issues that we've done. The best way to get a copy of it is just check your local newsstand, Far Out Magazine.
We're out of time. Thanks very much. Hope you enjoyed this edition of Don Ecker Live.
Well, that was Larry King telling us it's almost all over. Somebody put a note up here for me to give out UFO Magazine's telephone number once again. That's 818-90. Does Far Out have a magazine where somebody can call up and find out about it?
Far Out have a telephone?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there are two ways to reach me. One would be Area Throno 85. Other way is just to contact Don Ecker at UFO Magazine, and he'll pass along messages to me.
Okay, that's it for another week. Bill, will you come back again?
At some point, certainly. Be glad to.
That's it for another week. Next week, my guest is going to be Dr. Barry Taff. He's going to be talking about some of his very unusual research. That's it for a week. Remember, keep your eyes to the skies, and here's my song.